Welcome. You're listening to Ask the Doulas, a podcast where we talk to experts from all over the country about topics related to pregnancy, birth, postpartum, and early parenting. Let's chat.
Hello, hello. This is Kristen with Ask the Doulas, and I'm here to chat with Michelle Valucanis. Today, she's the proud mom of her angel, Sweet Pea, who she lost due to miscarriage, her angel daughter, Colette Luis, who she lost at 9 days old, and her only living child, her rainbow baby, Elliot Miguel. Inspired by her journey with Colette, Michelle and her husband founded the Colette Louise Tisdale Foundation, whose mission is to improve outcomes of pregnancy, childbirth, prematurity, and infancy, as well as aid in the grieving process through financial assistance, education, and advocacy. Their flagship program financially assists families dealing with high risk and complicated pregnancies, NICU stays, and loss. The organization's ability to help families relies on donations and grants, and they are grateful if you're able to donate. Michelle also participates and advocates on issues of maternal health, maternal mortality, infant health and safety, and pregnancy complications. Michelle lives in Glenville, Illinois, with her son Elliot, husband Mark, and dog Nemo. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So happy to chat with you. So would love to hear more about your personal story and why, you know, this was on your heart. I know it's so much work to start a foundation and to maintain it and promote it. So yeah, I would love to hear more about your journey.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think the journey began when we started trying for kids and, you know, we're both reasonably healthy people and no real issues. And so we kind of expected, you know, a couple of months and, you know, the tests would show that we would be pregnant, we'd go on. And really what we found was that over and over again, we weren't getting pregnant. And when we sought out infertility testing and results, it was really an unknown cause. And that's particularly frustrating. And I think that that was sort of the start of the loss of control that you have over so many things. Sure. And so we started with infertility treatments. And, you know, that in and of itself is a whole big, you know, mess of things, that a lot of stuff that happens, a lot of timing, again, the loss of control, like you don't have, you know, it has to go by how your body is reacting to treatment. So you no longer have the control over your schedule, you know, and you're trying to do this. And, you know, I was trying to work at the same time and, you know, having to take days off and come in late and all of that. And that was a difficult journey. When we finally decided to go to IVF, we got pregnant on our first round. And that was, we were thrilled. We just thought, okay, maybe we just needed the extra help. And so we were thrilled. We told everybody in our family. It was really just an exciting time. And a few weeks later, I started bleeding and we went to the doctor and for an ultrasound check, and they could see a gestational sac, but no baby. And so they said, you know, you're in the process of miscarrying and we expect it'll pass naturally, but we'll do blood work now and then we'll have you repeat it in a few days just to make sure. And that was the Friday before Mother's Day of 2017, which, you know, I still have visions my husband had decided, because I said, finally, I get to celebrate Mother's Day. And so he had planned things like, I know later on, he told me the story of he was on the phone with Edible Arrangements saying, please, you cannot deliver this. Like, you cannot deliver this. So every once in a while, when I need a laugh, I think of him, you know, tackling a delivery guy and fruit all over our lawn, you know, because I think that, you know, really like laughter was really the important thing. And that was the thing that got carried through us through all of this. And when I went back for repeat, blood work, they found my numbers were rising. And so they said, come in for an ultrasound. And really was at the point of maybe you're not naturally miscarrying and we're going to have to do a DNC.
Yeah.
So during the ultrasound, they found a heartbeat and said, okay, we were wrong. Baby's just measuring really small. And was measuring a little bit small. And that's why we didn't see a few days ago. So you're pregnant, you know, start back up and everything. And that's, you know, really stunning news to hear and really just kind of messed with us. And so somehow we managed to go to work that day. And after work, I was meeting up with my sister. And as I was meeting with her, I felt a gush of blood. And so I fully miscarried and ended up in the ER, where they told us, yes, everything has passed, no gestational sac, nothing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, having to relive it again in such a short time, I mean, we were talking Friday to Wednesday, was really tough. And that really took a strain on us. And that was a really low point, I think, for us in our relationship and our marriage. And I found that we weren't sort of pushing each other away in a lot of ways, instead of trying to grieve together. And that was something that I made sure after we had been in that for about a week or so, I really made sure of that and insisted that we start couples counseling and really work through that, because I thought, we can't do this where we're pushing each other away. This isn't going to work. And so, you know, I wanted to get right back to trying again, and my husband supported me. And we had a failed IVF, and then we got pregnant with Colette. And, you know, we were so thrilled. Oh my God, did I have pregnancy symptoms? We actually found out we were pregnant with her a couple days after Christmas 2017. And at Christmas, apparently my whole family knew, because at one point my sister gave me a tote bag that had a picture drawn of my dog and his name, and I started crying. And they were like, it's not a crying thing. Like, what is going on with you? And so I had every pregnancy symptom and terrible morning sickness. That is the most misused word, because it's not morning sickness. It's just, sickness. But that all meant I was still pregnant. And so we went through it and we got past the first trimester and, you know, really were excited. I was excited to tell my employees. I was excited to tell, you know, the world, my friends, everybody. And everybody was so excited for us. And, you know, things were going well. And we were doing this. We crossed in the second trimester. And at 21 weeks pregnant, I went to a standard OB appointment. Actually, that day, I felt the best I had felt during the entire pregnancy. I had energy. You know, I finally was like, oh, this is what they say, the second trimester, you have like this boost of energy. I get it now. Okay, I feel better. And my blood pressure was 188 over 110. And so I was sent to labor and delivery. And then I was admitted to the hospital and was told, you'll be here until you deliver. And so, just to give you like a frame of reference, that was an evening of May 8th, and I was not due until September 7th.
Wow. Okay.
And so, yeah, so a really long time, and just, you know, what does this mean? And so went with it. And one of the things that really started sticking to me was that, you know, when they told me that, I had a million questions in my head, right? Everything from what I now realize as a parent is, you know, the stupid minor stuff at this point was like, we don't have a car seat. We don't have a crib. What are we going to do? To, you know, the important stuff, like, I supervised a team. What were we going to, you know, how was I going to do that from the hospital? I hadn't had a plan. There wasn't a backup for me. There wasn't, you know, all of that stuff. To, am I going to survive this? Is my baby going to survive this? And so really, you know, kind of struggling with all of those things. And, you know, it's really scary. They come in and they start, you know, spouting a bunch of numbers at you about survival rates and, you know, what their treatment will be once you get to this week, you know, all of these things. And they're coming in, and they're, at one point I had a doctor who said, let's just sign it now since we know we're going to do a C-section. And I said, well, maybe not. And she looked at me and she said, we're going to do a C-section. And, you know, all of those things. So everything was like just, you know, pulled away. But when I had time to settle, I really thought about, where am I blessed? And one of the things that I really thought of was, I didn't have to worry about money. And all of this, that was like a big thing that was just off my mind. And I knew how lucky I was to be in that position. And so I started thinking already at that point of doing something. And when I said doing something, I don't know what that meant at that point.
Okay.
And, you know, it went on. And so ultimately, I was in the hospital a little over 3 weeks. And when we had done an ultrasound when I was first admitted, Colette was measuring a little bit behind, and the doctors were not super scared. They were hoping that once they regulated my blood pressure and everything, that she would catch up. And when they did a repeat ultrasound, what they found was not only had she not caught up, but she had had no growth in that 3 week period. And so they came basically saying, you know, really, we think that the best thing to do is to deliver, because we have more interventions we can do on the outside. And so we went and, you know, I had an emergency C-section and they pulled her out. And, you know, it was a lot of things that she really defied right at the beginning. So one of the things they had said to us to prepare us, and everyone had said to us a bunch of different times, was, you won't hear her. She's too young to, you know, cry or make sounds. And after they took her out, some of the chaos was, you know, a little bit over for me, at least. And they were taking care of her. All of a sudden the room got quiet and there was a little squeak. And I said, is that her? And then all the doctors, and they said, yes. And then all the doctors and nurses were like, shouldn't be able to make that sound. And so I thought, well, of course, this is my badass daughter who's going to defy everything. Right.
Right.
And then they had warned us about one of the worries of interventions was if the smallest intubation tube didn't fit for her, then they couldn't intubate. And then they weren't left with very many options. And the second to smallest fit her. So it was just all these little things were happening. And so she was in the NICU, straight to the NICU. And that, again, you know, sort of is just a really chaotic time and stressful time. And I think the best advice that I got was from my mom, who was herself a former preemie mom. My sister was about 8 weeks early.
Okay.
And she said to me, she said, okay, look, this is a roller coaster. And she said, and like, I mean, it's a roller coaster. You're going to feel great in the morning because your baby is doing so well. And then by the evening, you're going to feel like terrible because all of a sudden something happened. And she said, and then vice versa. And she said, sometimes you might ride the roller coaster up and down 2 or 3 times in a day. She's like, you just have to hang on. And that was really important advice that I always appreciated having, because that is really what happens, right? So.
Hey, Alyssa here. I'm just popping in to tell you about our course called Becoming. Becoming a Mother is your guide to a confident pregnancy and birth, all in a convenient 6-week online program. From birth plans to sleep training and everything in between, you'll gain the confidence and skills you need for a smooth transition to motherhood. You'll get live coaching calls with Kristen and myself, a bunch of expert videos, including chiropractic care, pelvic floor physical therapy, mental health experts, breastfeeding, and much more. You'll also get a private Facebook community with other mothers going through this at the same time as you to offer support and encouragement when you need it most. And then, of course, you'll also have direct email access to me and Kristen, in addition to the live coaching calls. If you'd like to learn more about the course, you can email us at info@goldcoastdoulas.com or check it out at thebecomingcourse.com. We'd love to see you there.
So we settled into kind of a routine once I was released from the hospital. And so my husband would get up early and he would go into work. And on his way into work, he would call the nurses. Since I was recovering from a C-section, would move a little bit slower. And so I would get up and move slowly and then get ready. And I would go over to the hospital and usually stay there most of the day.
That's a lot.
And then, right. Yes. And then my husband would join me after work and we would spend some time with her. And then we would both go home. And when my husband would call the nurse in the morning, he'd send me a message or, you know, give me a call and say like, oh, you know, this happened overnight, or she's stable, or whatever it was.
Yeah.
And so on her 9th day of life, same kind of, you know, plan happened, but my husband called me and he said, yeah. So when I called the nurses, they put the doctor on, and I thought, oh shit. And he said they had jumpstart her heart last night and there's some concern about how she's doing. And he was like, I'm going to go into work, but let me know anything. And I, you know, basically got dressed very fast and got out the door and went to the hospital. And I was in denial and, you know, like, oh, you know, we went through this. There was another time where they called us at, you know, 3 a.m. and it was a whole thing and she pulled through and she was fine. And when I got there, the doctor said to me, yeah, hold on, let's talk. And, you know, again, these are kind of the words that, you know, in the medical system, you're like, crap. And he found a private room for us and he proceeded to tell us, which was a worry we had always had. So typically with micro preemies that are that small, so Colette was a little over a pound when she was born, they will place them onto a certain ventilator. And that is supposed to be a temporary thing to get their lungs, give them time for treatments and things that hurt their lungs, get healthier. And then after a time, they'll switch them to a different ventilator, because that first one, while it's amazing and wonderful and helps so many of my preemies, can also, after a little bit, can start stripping the lungs. And so they had tried to move Colette several times onto the other ventilator. She would take it for maybe 5-10 minutes, and then they would start to see numbers crash, and they'd have to bring her back to the first ventilator. And so really it was that now what we had feared was they couldn't get her onto the other ventilator, and the first one had started to strip away at her lungs, and as she was suffering, and they just didn't see that they could make it better. They were going to do everything they could, but they really wanted us to be aware of what was going on. You know, I sat there and listened and nodded my head. And again, I mean, total denial. I was like, oh, they're going to freak us out and she's going to pull through and she's going to be fine. And, you know, he said, you can stay here as long as you want. And as he turned to leave, he came back and he said, do you believe in baptism? And I said, I do. And he said, I think it's time. And that to me was like a really like, so this is really what you think is happening. And so I called my husband and he came and family members came. And I still was in this, like, she's just going to pull through. I mean, this is not what happens. And then I started to turn when she was going in, they were going into shift change, and shift change in the NICU, parents weren't allowed in. And so I was actually in the family room with my sister-in-law. And then the nurse came in and said, Mom, you should come in. And I was like, it's 2 minutes to shift change. And so they let us stay throughout shift change. And then at some point, and I don't remember exactly when that happened, they were pretty strict about 2 visitors. And so it was my husband and I in there. And at some point, my sister was able to come in. And it was like, you're bending these rules and you're only doing this if this is really serious. And so ultimately, you know, we saw her numbers drop and they said, we will keep her alive. We'll baptize her. And then you guys will get to hold her while she passes. And so, you know, we said goodbye in the best way possible. We were in a family room. And so our parents, both of our sisters and both of our brothers-in-law were able to be there. And we all got to hold her. We all cried together and, you know, hugged and did everything. And ultimately, you know, said goodbye to her. And that was, you know, it's still surreal to think that that's what happened. And, you know, it's just, it's the most devastating time. And then, you know, they come out and I still remember somebody coming in and talking to us and saying the phrase, do you guys have a funeral home in mind? And just thinking, no, both of my parents were alive. My husband was, you know, in college when his father died. We hadn't planned a funeral. We didn't know what to do. And so, and you're definitely not thinking that when you're preparing to have a baby. You're not thinking about a funeral home at that point. And so, you know, it was really just, it was devastating, it was sad, it felt isolating. You know, it was just one of those things. I mean, I felt so much guilt thinking it was my fault and it was my body. But again, you know, sort of that money thing came up. It was at one point, I guess I must have had a weird look on my face. And so the person who had come into the room, and I don't remember if it was doctor, nurse, social worker, other random person, I don't know who it was. And he said, you know, if money is an issue, a lot of people cremate because it's much cheaper. And that has always, like, it hit me hard that day and it's always stayed with me is, why are parents having to choose something and how they memorialize their child who died when over money? And that really stuck with me. And so again, it was all those money things just coming in throughout the process. And
like medical bills and then your
medical bills. Yes. And then, you know, just cost of transportation. You know, one of the people who was in the same pod as us in NICU, who had probably I'm in Chicago area, in good Chicago traffic, had probably an hour 15 drive because that was the closest NICU to them. And so that expense of gas, I mean, you know, and this was when gas prices were good. So like now if we think about, you know, as gas prices have risen and dropped and all that, how much worse that is, usually at a time when one or both parents are either working less or not working. And so all of those things really were folding into my mind. And so, you know, really left with thinking about it, we decided this is what we're going to do. And so we established our nonprofit, our foundation, with, you know, really trying to do financial assistance for kind of what we see as essentially the three stages of Colette's life. So high risk pregnancy or pregnancy that develops complications, yes. NICU stay or loss. And, you know, in a lot of ways, this is me running it is how I'm parenting Colette. And it looks very different. And it's very different than I parent my living son. But, you know, that's really what I think is really truly important is to be in that spot and be able to do it. So we've been in operation a little over 4 years. I think we're coming up probably about a month on our like anniversary from the first grant we gave. And we've given away over $1 million in grants.
It's amazing.
The families across the nation. And yeah, and the need is astounding to me. Like just, you know, I probably had the biggest vision of what this was going to look like and what the need really was. And I am constantly shocked by just how much need there is. And so, yeah, so that's really what we're doing. And, you know, along the way, we realized how many issues the general public wasn't aware of. And so we also do some education and then advocacy where we can, because, you know, really some of these problems are so structural and so institutional that we need to really change those in order to change the course of some of our mission. So
how do families, if they are seeking assistance from your foundation, how do they connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So they connect on our website. There's a brief application that they fill out. And then we also need a verification. So that's typically, we like the vast majority of times, it's social workers who are submitting those. But it could be a case manager. Could be we've had some doctors and nurses. It could be a death certificate or other paperwork that's from the hospital that establishes it. But basically just a third party verification of it. And once we have those, my husband and I review them every week and we give a decision. So basically if your application verification, everything is in Friday at 5, then we review it on Saturday and you'd have a decision by Monday morning. And then once you get a decision, so the decision is usually we're going to approve you for this for X dollar amount. And then clients have to submit where they want to spend that. And we would pay the bills directly to service providers. So directly to utility company, directly to a landlord, that kind of thing. The only kind of, I guess, exception of sorts is we do gas gift cards. And
that's great.
That had been our biggest request for some time. And we have actually now seen in the last couple of months that rent is actually a bigger need. We're actually giving away more in rent dollars than in gas gift cards.
And makes sense with the rising housing costs. Yeah.
And so, which is also, I mean, it's all interesting to see like how shifts in, you know, the greater world affect families and, you know, where they're at. So yeah, so that's basically what happened. So it's a very quick turnaround that was intentional because we know things are happening very fast and that people need help when they need help. And, you know, usually when they're turning to us, things are already pretty bad on that front. Right. And so, yeah, so that's really what the process is.
And how do our listeners get involved or donate?
So, you know, donations are great. What we have built in a structure is we have a generous donor who is covering essentially all of our overhead. So postage and website hosting and all of those things. So donations to us go 100% to families in need. So it just goes straight into that fund. So you know that you're not paying for anything other than helping a family. And we really appreciate that. You know, the ability to give really is affected by what's coming in. And so we appreciate that for sure. And in terms of getting involved, I mean, I think, you know, spreading the word, whether that be for, you know, for families who might need help or people who might be interested in donating, I think that's really important. You know, we are a small organization. It's essentially very much just me. We're doing a lot on a national scale. And so, you know, getting out the word, sharing some things, learning about something, and then really deciding to share it is really helpful for us.
That is fantastic. So you are, not only do you have the ColetteLuise.com website, but you're also on social media. So yes. If our listeners wanted to connect with you, what channels do you prefer they find you on?
So we're Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And any of those are great ways to reach out to us if that's your preferred method of communication. And we will respond and, you know, let you know how we can help or answer questions or anything like that.
Wonderful. So any final tips for our listeners navigating loss, Michelle?
Yeah, I think, you know, feel what you want to feel. Grief, you know, I think there we have this notion and, you know, that grief ends at some point and it doesn't. You know, grief is reactivated over and over again. And, you know, we just came off things like school pictures, right? The first day of school pictures, which are really popular to post on social media nowadays.
Yes.
But are really triggering for lost parents because if they're seeing somebody who's the same age as that what their child they lost would have been, that's really triggering. That's really difficult. And so sometimes there's a lot of grief over that. You know, we're coming up on Halloween, can be really tricky. The holidays can be really tricky. You know, there's just the random, you know, Tuesday, you know, out of the blue kind of hits you and overwhelms you. And all of those things together, you know, really means it's a life, you know, it's a lifelong struggle and it's working through it. I am a big proponent of therapy. So I say, you know, individual therapy, couples therapy, if you can do it, because there's still conflict and there's still issues to work through and to just make sure you're communicating about how all those things are affecting you. And then I always recommend finding sort of your village, your people, because I have found and I have a couple of really good close lost mom friends who are also parenting after loss. And it's really nice because all the thoughts you have, all the actions you take that you know are really resulted from grief. It's nice to be in a space where you can just reach out to other people and say, this is the thought I'm having, and that you're getting the, yep, I get that. Uh-huh. Yep. I felt that way too. And you're not feeling like you're alone.
Exactly.
And so I think that those are the really things I can say. You know, these are tragedies that honestly will bring out the true nature of other people in your lives. And there are people that are not going to be supportive. And it's really, you know, it's really devastating when that happens. And you have to make decisions as to whether or not those people should remain in your life. And if they are, how you're going to interact and deal with them. That's
a good point.
You know, that's really hard. And I think, so that's why I really say having your village is nice because you can sort of bounce that off and say, you know, I have this one friend who is saying X to me and we can kind of, you know, talk through that and see what does that mean? What does that look like? How are you going to deal with that? So I think that, you know, my best tip, I think for parenting after loss is tough. You know, there are things that I do and ways that I react. I go to the worst what if scenario in just about every case. So, you know, if he starts with a cold, I'm starting to worry about, oh my God, what if that turns into pneumonia or COVID or anything like that?
Right.
And that's really just because, you know, my experiences, my life has sort of like led me to this feeling of like, we are going to experience the worst case scenario. And luckily I have a very healthy, very active toddler who is always happy. And so that helps a lot, but still it's hard, you know? And so it's just all of those things, you know, right now he's not really talking yet. He's in speech and, you know, you can look up things and I have gone to everything from, you know, oh my God, he's deaf, which makes no sense. And we've tested him now to, you know, just all of the extremes that I've like gone to when all the experts are telling me, especially COVID babies are a lot of the times are being very delayed because they didn't have the same social interactions with other kids that they would have and other adults. And so, and it all makes sense to me logically. It's just those feelings, those pit of the stomach feelings that you have. And I think that's all, not only is it okay, it's just how it's going to be. And so I think, you know, really the individual therapy helps to make sure that you are not over worrying and, you know, doing things that are really harmful to you and harmful to your child, but also that you are still following your instincts and doing that. And you know, it's hard. I mean, parenting is tough. We all know that. And, you know, trusting your instinct is a good thing. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell when it's just my mom instinct kicking in,
right,
and the feeling, or if it's coming from loss. And because I never parented without the loss, I don't know. You know, I don't know which one it is. And that is really difficult to navigate and to figure out.
Thank you for sharing those tips, and your story will help so many listeners, and especially the work you're doing with the foundation.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure chatting with you, and we'll be in touch soon.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Michelle.
thanks for listening to Ask the Doulas. For more information about Gold Coast Doulas, visit us on our website, goldcoastdoulas.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. Thank you. Remember, these moments are golden.